This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
The man who introduced Alexander Hamilton to a new generation is at it again. After Hamilton, he wrote about George Washington, and now he's taken on the story of another American icon, Ulysses S. Grant.
I thought it would be very interesting for both me and the reader to go from the victorious general of the Revolutionary War, who then became a two-term president, to go to the victorious general of the Civil War, who also became a two-term president.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we return to history class and learn about the Civil War hero and 18th president of the United States. We'll also spend an academic minute going way back in history to when early humans started thinking like humans. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Ron Chernow is an award-winning author, recipient of the 2015 National Humanities Medal. His first book, The House of Morgan, won the National Book Award. Washington, A Life, won the Pulitzer Prize for Biography. And Alexander Hamilton, the inspiration for the Broadway musical, won the American History Book Prize. His new book is simply called Grant, and it tries to provide a complete understanding of Ulysses S. Grant, the general and president whose fortunes rose and fell with dizzying speed and frequency. The Best of Our Knowledge is Joe Donahue spoke to Ron Chernow about the new book and asked what got the story of Grant on his radar.
Well, I had always had a fantasy of doing a big sweeping saga about the Civil War and Reconstruction, and Grant is really the main figure who unites those two periods. And also, after I finished my Washington biography, I thought it would be very interesting for both me and the reader to go from the victorious general of the Revolutionary War, who then became a two-term president, to go to the victorious general of the Civil War, who also became a two-term president. And so there were a number of reasons that led me to this topic.
Give us a sense of his upbringing, of growing up in Southwest Ohio, and what that strict Methodist upbringing was like.
Right. Grant grew up in a strict Methodist household that frowned on dancing, drinking, card playing, in other words, anything that could vaguely be considered fun. It was a pretty austere household. And Grant was a surprisingly sensitive and gentle young boy for somebody who later became a general. In fact, his father owned a tannery across the street from the house, and these noxious fumes from the tannery would waft across the street into Ulysses' bedroom. And he was so revolted by it that for the rest of his life, he could not eat meat swimming in its own juices. Meat had to be burnt to a dry crisp, so that early exposure to the tannery had a profound impact on him.
You portray him, and I tell me if this is accurate, as I'm looking for a better word than prude, and perhaps you could help out.
He was very gentlemanly. He was almost ladylike. He was a very, very well-mannered young man. It's rare when you do a biography of someone this powerful that there are no rumors whatsoever of philandering. In fact, his marriage to Julia Dent was so happy that people said that they were almost like teenagers. They would sit there holding hands with each other. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. Grant was like a very fastidious, gentlemanly character.
He was born Hiram Ulysses Grant, and amusingly, that was changed because who wants the initials HUG?
Right, exactly. And the boys teased him mercilessly about the HUG initials, so he dropped the Hiram. He became plain Ulysses. And then his father decided that Ulysses was going to go to West Point, not because he wanted the boy to be a warrior, but his father was a real skinflint, and West Point represented a free form of vocational education. And when the local congressman nominated Grant to the academy, he accidentally sent in the name as Ulysses S. Grant. And for the rest of his life, poor Grant had to explain to people that the S stood for absolutely nothing.
Much like Harry S. Truman, I believe.
Exactly. Yeah. Interesting parallel, isn't it? Yeah.
So when he goes to West Point, and he does okay. He's not great, but he does okay.
Yeah, he's lackluster. He's a middling student and graduates just around the middle of his class. And by the time that he graduates from the academy, this is not the story of someone with fire in the belly as a young man. By the time he graduates from the academy, his highest ambition in life is to be an assistant math professor at the academy. Not a full professor, mind you, but an assistant math professor. Hard to believe that this character then ends up being general in chief with a million soldiers under his command.
At the point of taking on the story for you, I do find it interesting because you talk about the fire in the belly. This is very unlike the characters you have written about prior.
Yeah, all the people I've written about, J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, I all sensed as I was researching their lives that by the time that they were teenagers, they were already lusting for fame and glory, and you felt that they were going to achieve it because there was a drive and an ambition and an enterprise that almost guaranteed that they would succeed. This was not the case with Grant, who could easily have ended up living an obscure and completely forgettable life and went through, before the Civil War, multiple business failures. And in fact, he's reduced to selling firewood on street corners in St. Louis and has to pawn his watch to buy Christmas presents for his wife and children. And then in the ultimate humiliation, he's forced to go to work as a clerk junior to his two younger brothers in his father's leather goods store in Galena, Illinois. And it's after a year there that the Civil War breaks out and rescues Grant from a life of failure and mediocrity. And by that point, he was almost 40 years old.
So after the South fired on Fort Sumter in 1861, in April of that year, and you chronicle this, his rise in the Union Army is incredible. I mean, miraculous.
Yeah, I mean, this gives new definition to the word meteoric, because 2 months after Fort Sumter, he's a colonel, and then 4 months later, he's a brigadier general, and 10 months later, he's a major general, and then by the end of the war, he has the title of lieutenant general. He's the first one to hold that title since George Washington, and he has a million soldiers under his command, and that was by far the largest military machine that the United States had created up until that point in our history.
Allow me just to take a step back, because at this point, he's in his late 30s, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, but, you know, he still has, the time the war breaks out, there's a desperate shortage of officers, and Grant has all of that old West Point lore still stored in his mind. Mm-hmm. And also, he had fought for several years with distinction in the Mexican War, where he not only saw a lot of combat, but he was a quartermaster, which meant that he mastered supplies and logistics, and this would be extremely important in the Civil War, when he was supervising armies across a 1,500-mile area, and it's Grant's mastery of the nuts and bolts of armies, as much as his mastery of battlefield tactics and strategy, that will lead to Union victory.
I do want to just touch on something that you write about. It seems like you did quite a bit of research of looking into what has become what many, if not most people, know about Grant or think they know about Grant, of that he was a drunkard. You really look at this and come out saying this man, yes, was an alcoholic.
Well, it's very interesting, because when I started working on the book, my friend Harold Holzer, who's a great Lincoln authority, yeah, said, you know, it would be nice to settle the drinking issue once and for all. And what has made it difficult for historians to deal with this is that there were a lot of people who claimed to have seen Grant drunk, but there were also a lot of people who worked very closely with him who said, I never saw him touch a drop of alcohol. And I document the drinking problem at great length, and what I discovered was that Grant was a binge drinker who wouldn't touch a drop of alcohol for 2-3 months, and then he would go on a 2-3 day bender. He had the classic marks of an alcoholic. By his own admission, once he took one glass, you know, he could not stop. And it would trigger a rather extreme personality change, that he was a rather tightly buttoned up character, and he would become this rather jovial and even silly person who slurred his words and stumbled about the room. He had enough control over this problem. He never drank on the eve of battle, certainly never during battle, never jeopardized the lives of his men. But when the battle was over and the pressure was off, he would allow himself these benders by going to another city where his officers and soldiers would not see him.
You tell a story in the book about his chief of staff, John Rawlins, and the role that he played throughout, really through the Civil War, of helping Grant and playing off the drinking problem.
Yeah, this is arguably the most interesting relationship in Grant's life, because Rawlins is a young lawyer from Galena. Grant invites him onto his staff as adjutant and then chief of staff. And Rawlins, who's the son of an alcoholic who feared that he himself was an alcoholic, joins the staff on one condition: that Grant swear that he will not touch a drop of liquor during the war, or he, Rawlins, you know, will quit the staff. Well, what happens turns out to be very complicated, because Grant has many lapses. And Rawlins, who was almost messianic on this issue and swore a blue streak, told Grant to offer no uncertain terms. But he didn't quit his staff for the simple reason that Rawlins was a fiercely patriotic young man, and he really felt that the fate of the Union rested on Grant's shoulders. So he's inwardly chastising Grant on a fairly regular basis, while outwardly reassuring the world that the drinking stories are all overblown. I think we owe a great debt to John Rawlins for keeping Grant in one piece during the war.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Ron Chernow continues with a comparison between General Grant and the other famous military leader of the time, Robert E. Lee. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. We're back in history class today, and our guest is Ron Chernow, author of the new biography simply called Grant, an in-depth look at the life of the Civil War general and the 18th president of the United States. Chernow is speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
Let me ask you about the success as a general and his extraordinary success as a strategist. You write about this, of what he was able to do, the preparation and the maneuvers that he would come up were nothing short of extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Grant has this caricature of Grant that he won because he was this crude and brutal general who hurled tens of thousands of young men to their death. In fact, he really was the master strategist of the war. He captures three Confederate armies during the war: at Fort Donelson in Tennessee in 1862, at Vicksburg, Mississippi in 1863, and most famously, Lee's army at Appomattox Courthouse in April 1865. Robert E. Lee never captured a single Union army, so it's kind of interesting that Lee then became venerated as the superior general, whereas Grant was derided, you know, as this filthy butcher. You know, what he did when he became general-in-chief, the various Union armies had been operating independently of each other in the various theaters of war, and Grant coordinates their movements so that they're functioning as a single fighting force, applying unremitting pressure against the Confederacy across a very, very broad front, and that turns out to be the winning ticket. William Tecumseh Sherman said afterwards, he said, Grant's strategy embraced a continent, Lee's only a small state, that is Virginia.
With that said, and you write about this as well, but how did Grant view Robert E. Lee?
Grant respected Lee, although he thought that he was overrated. Grant made the interesting observation. He said that Robert E. Lee is a man who needs sunshine. He felt that Lee was in an easier political situation in the South than he was in the North, because he felt that there was this uncritical adoration of Lee in the Southern press and among politicians, whereas there was this enormous dissident, you know, so-called Copperhead press in the North that was very critical of Grant. And so it's very interesting that when Grant was asked who was the greatest Southern general, he said Joseph Johnston. And when Lee was asked who was the greatest Northern general, he said George McClellan. I don't think that any historians would agree, you know, with that. But I think that they were thrust into this competitive situation. So I think that it was very hard for each to acknowledge just how good the other was.
And then, of course, we all know about the meeting between the two at Appomattox Courthouse. How did that come about? And ultimately, what did that do to the image of each man?
Well, what happened was, you know, that Grant had laid down a long siege of Lee's army at Richmond and Petersburg. And then early April 1865, Richmond and Petersburg fall. Lee and his army, you know, race west to try to escape. Grant and his army with Phil Sheridan managed to overtake him, really encircle his army and prevent Lee from getting any new supplies, which forces Lee to surrender. Grant is extremely magnanimous in victory. The Southern soldiers are starving. He immediately issues 25,000 rations. He lets the soldiers keep their horses. He lets the officers keep their firearms. And most importantly, he doesn't allow his men to either gloat or celebrate. In fact, when his wife Julia suggests that he go to Richmond, which had been the capital of the Confederacy, which had now fallen, Grant turns to her and says, "Julia, don't you realize how bitter the defeat is for these people, and it would only worsen things if I went there and gloated over our victory?"
You write about the tale of what happened to Ulysses and Julia Grant on the day of Lincoln's assassination. Tell us a little bit about that story and what happens.
Yeah, this is certainly one of the most extraordinary moments, you know, in their lives, because a few weeks before Lincoln's assassination, there'd been a terrible scene between Julia Grant and Mary Lincoln. Mary Lincoln was increasingly depressed and disturbed. And threw a temper tantrum. And so the night that the Lincolns went to Ford's Theater, they wanted Ulysses and Julia Grant to go with them. And Lincoln actually said to Grant at the White House that day, he said, "The public, you know, public wants to see the victorious president and the victorious general together." Julia said she refused to go because Mary Lincoln would be there. And so the Grants decided instead that they would go to their home in Burlington, New Jersey. Well, it turned out that at lunchtime that day, Julia was sitting having lunch at the Willard Hotel around the corner from the White House, and there was this strange, beady-eyed man who was playing with his fork and kind of looking at her in this menacing way that she found very unsettling. And then later in the afternoon, the Grants are in a carriage going to the train station, and that same man suddenly gallops by on horseback and keeps galloping by them, circling around, glaring in at them in a way that now Ulysses finds upsetting, and then rides away. And the next day, when Grant sets eyes on pictures of John Wilkes Booth for the first time, he immediately realizes that the horseman was Booth, and Julia said that the man she had seen at lunch that day toying with the soup spoon had been John Wilkes Booth, so that the Grants were also being stalked. And we'll never know, had they gone to Ford's Theater, maybe Ulysses S. Grant, you know, would have died along with Lincoln, or maybe Grant and his entourage or security people would have prevented the assassination from taking place. It's one of the great what-ifs of history.
You describe in the book in great detail about Grant's two-term presidency. It certainly had its ups and downs. It had its scandals, but it also had its successes as well.
Yeah, I mean, the stereotype of Grant's presidency is, you know, this corrupt administration. There were quite a number of scandals, not personally involving Grant, but Grant was kind of an incurably naive person in certain ways who was sort of blind to unscrupulous people around him. But what I try to argue in the book is that far from being a failed presidency, that the big issue of Grant's presidency is extraordinary actions that he takes to protect the 4 million former slaves who are now full-fledged American citizens. And because of the 15th Amendment, which Grant had really helped to push through, those 4 million former slaves now have voting rights. And this petrifies Southern whites, and there is a violent reaction in the form of the Ku Klux Klan. And Grant appoints a crusading attorney general from Georgia named Amos Ackerman, who uses a newly created Justice Department to go into the South and crush the Klan. They bring more than 3,000 indictments, get more than 1,000 convictions, to the point where Frederick Douglass says the scourging of our people, you know, has stopped because of this. And this seems to me, in terms of its consequences then and its legacy now, a much more important thing than the, you know, various minor scandals that happened during his presidency.
Of course, where we're located in Albany nearby is Mount McGregor, and that is where Grant died. What brought him there?
Yeah, it's a poignant story because he's at Mount McGregor about the last 5 or 6 weeks of his life. Grant was dying of cancer of the throat and tongue. He also, the year before, had been wiped out by the Bernie Madoff of his day, a young man named Ferdinand Ward. So Grant suddenly woke up one day to discover that he was completely busted. Financially, he decides to write his memoirs, which he does amazingly during the last year of his life. And during those final weeks, his doctors think that the pine-scented mountain air of Mount McGregor, you know, will be good both for his health and frame of mind. And there was a hotel there, the Balmoral Hotel. It's partly owned by Anthony Drexel, who had a cottage kind of down the road. And he let Grant use the cottage where he completed the memoirs. And there are very moving pictures of Grant sitting on the porch at Mount McGregor. And even though it's he's sitting there in July heat, he is all wrapped up and he has a scarf over his neck because there was a tumor probably about the size of a baseball that was bulging from his neck. And he died there, and it's still a very, very moving place to go. They still have a lot of the memorial wreaths that were sent. And kind of when you walk into the house, you feel like Grant had just died the day before. Mm-hmm.
Again, the name of Ron Chernow's new biography is Grant. It's published by Penguin. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Since we're talking history today, let's go way back to when humans started thinking like, well, humans. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
To view history, let's dig into our brains instead of the earth. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Shelby Putt, postdoctoral research fellow at Indiana University, discusses why learning how our ancestors used their brains can help us understand the evolutionary puzzle.
At what point in evolutionary history did our human ancestors start to think more like humans and less like apes? This is a hard question to answer without a time machine because, unlike bones, intelligence doesn't fossilize. So my team came up with a unique solution. Using a neuroimaging technique called functional near-infrared spectroscopy, we monitored brain activity in modern-day humans as they made the same types of stone tools as early humans. This let us glimpse what parts of the brain are required to make specific stone tools, both in the present and in the past. Our study's participants learned how to make simple Oldowan flake and pebble tools and Acheulean hand axes. We chose these because the transition from the Oldowan era to the Acheulean era, about 1.8 million years ago, is when our brains nearly doubled in size. It's therefore seen as a turning point in human cognitive evolution. Our study's results support this hypothesis. We discover that the older form of toolmaking activates brain areas involved in visual inspection and hand movement. It would not be a surprise to find a similar brain network activated in chimpanzees when they crack nuts with stone tools. But the more recent form of toolmaking activates a higher-order cognitive network in the brain, involved in higher-level motor planning and managing multisensory information with working memory. Interestingly, this cognitive network is the same one that lights up when a trained pianist plays the piano. While early humans probably couldn't play Mozart, our study shows that the same brain network we rely on today to complete complex tasks was likely already evolving 1.8 million years ago.
That was Shelby Putt of Indiana University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.